Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Classical Liberalism. Recorded in 2024, Dennis McQuistion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, and Richard Epstein, Tisch professor of law at NYU, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and professor of law at the University of Chicago, discuss the historical origins of classical liberalism, what it means, and why it's important to understand. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, welcome. I'm Dennis McQuistion, and this is a topic about classical liberalism and whether you know what it is and why it's important. And, you know, the thing is, in a world of, let's just say, polarized political parties and people yelling at each other all the time across the political spectrum, I find it difficult not only to know where somebody else is coming from, but even sometimes kind of knowing where we are, ourselves are coming from, because we've got all these terms that we throw about. As an example, Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Green Party, Independents, Conservative, Liberals, Progressives. And so the terms probably have different meanings to different people. The important thing today, though, is how we see the role of government and the political process and whether different philosophical positions are what led to, let's just say, the forming of the United States of America, and whether or not viewers like you and citizens in general would be better served by understanding what was going on in the 17th and 18th century that led to the issue of what we call a classical liberal. And joining me on this program is a guy who wrote a book on the classical liberal constitution, Richard Epstein, and he was in town today in Dallas for the Institute for Policy Innovation. He is the Tisch Professor of Law at NYU. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's a distinguished service professor of law at the University of Chicago. And in addition to other books, the one I just mentioned, he wrote a book called Takings, and he was on our program on that subject, I don't know, something over 20 years ago, Richard. But Richard, for that person who may be a little bit unsure what a classical liberal is, why don't you tell us what a classical liberal is and why it's important?
Oh, it's a very funny term, because none of the classical liberals that we know, the people at the founding parties and their intellectual heirs, Locke, people like Hobbes in a strange way, but not quite, Hume, Madison, and so forth, would ever call themselves classical liberals. They called themselves liberals because they were in opposition to the conservative parties at the time, and they tended to think generally that rationality as opposed to tradition was a better way in order to achieve various things. And the rationality that they were thinking about in many cases sort of distilled itself back into two propositions. One was an anti-mercantilist proposition associated with Adam Smith. And if you go look back at The Wealth of Nations, written in 1776, the year that we had our emancipation, the book ends on the dangers of mercantilism, where trade is going to be rigged between companies in ways that will destroy the competitive equilibrium. And he was absolutely right about that. It doesn't matter whether you give export subsidies or import tariffs or quantitative restrictions. The free flow of goods across various markets is going to be absolutely critical, because competition and only competition can generate growth on the one hand and a fair distribution of wealth on the other. Very much his views. The other thing about classical liberalism was the way in which you started to think about government at the time. And the argument there was that government was some kind of monopoly. And if you give all the keys to a single Hobbesian king, what's going to happen is the institutions that you want to create on the private market side, that is, competitive institutions within states and across state boundaries, will not exist because some despot could absolutely shut them down. And there was the famous Hobbesian position, which says essentially there's a single sovereign with absolute power, and the way in which people keep them in line is to kill themselves or to rebel against them if something goes wrong. And there was much of that in John Locke when he said, you get to a tyrant, what do? You appeal to heaven, was his phrase. And that meant what you did is you essentially staged a principled revolution in an effort to get things back to the equilibrium. So as always, the other problem is how you keep competitive markets when the ultimate source of political power was going to danger towards constitutional corruption. And we developed then a set of institutions, two of them most notably, to try to deal with that problem. One of them was the institution of federalism, and the way in which it was described at the time is the federal government gets limited and enumerated powers, and the state government has the so-called residual powers, large and diffuse and not mentioned. And so if you weren't in the enumerated list for the federal government, you were on the state side. And then you had separation of powers. And so you have a president who runs the executive office, but his job is to enforce the laws that are passed by the legislative branch, the Congress, with two houses. Those two houses are set up in tension to one another. The House of Representatives has 2 years terms. The Senate has 6-year terms. You have to initiate some bills like revenue bills in the House, and other bills could be initiated in either House. And then you have to have agreement between the House to get it passed. Then there's a presidential veto, which could be overridden by 2/3 of the vote of the House. And it's clearly an effort to make passing laws more difficult rather than easier, on the assumption, if you don't know anything about the particular contents of the law, the presumption is you're better off without it, on the ground that less government has a presumptive legitimacy over claims for more government. And so you get this very complicated system. And the Constitution is a short document. It's under 8,000 words. And by the time they put it together, they were making some real speculations as to how things ought to work, because there was no system like this which had been created anywhere in the world.
Well, I was going to say, let me stop you there for a second, Richard, because I think what you put your finger on there, that is something that probably most of our viewers would know when we think about, but we forget how unique the system was when it was set up. And in fact, I'll never forget, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe after the Constitution, of course, was set up to, let's just say, amend the Articles of Confederation, but it ended up writing a new Constitution in 1787, if I'm not mistaken. And this lady named Mrs. Powell asked Benjamin Franklin, after he came out of the meeting, and said, "What have you gotten given us?" And he said, "Republic,
if you can keep it.
Differentiate, assuming that's accurate, what is a republic? And then we always talk about democracy these days. I mean, that's fuzzy.
The choice of the word republic was not an accident. In standard political theory at the time, there were three sets of oppositions. There was royalty, you know, a good king and a despot. There was an aristocracy of fine gentlemen. There was an oligarchy of evil gentlemen. And there was a republic, which was organized in an enlightened fashion. And there was a democracy, which was thought to be some kind of a rabble. And the difference between a republic and a democracy was in its structures and its institution. Democracy, you were always worried about the question of whether you have 50% plus one majority and you could wipe out the minority. And when they started to talk about the basic constitution without the Bill of Rights, the first intuition was that we're going to create very complicated legal processes which will make it hard for anybody to take over the whole system. And that's what led to having a separate Congress with House and representatives, the veto power, and all the rest of that stuff. And the theory at the time of the Constitution is to quote famous Alexander Hamilton's famous work. He says that the strongest Bill of Rights is essentially a structural constitution. It was very clear in the 1787 ratification debates that other people did not buy that. And what they said is you have to put in a Bill of Rights. Nobody thought at that particular time that you could do it before you ratified the Constitution. So there's a kind of an intertemporal deal. You pass this particular Constitution, and then when we get Congress into session, we'll adopt the Bill of Rights, which they did in 1791. And the bill, of course, was subject to a lot of contention, and there were all sorts of different provisions in there, each of which has generated its own fair of interpretive difficulties. But the basic kind of notion was that the First Amendment put limits on the power of Congress to pass laws abridging the freedom of the speech of the press or the establishment of the religion. And so you went through other them. And the other major ones here are two from the Fifth Amendment, which is one of them says you can't take property without due process of law. And the other one was essentially the takings clause, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And so the question is exactly how you read these things. So if you're a classical liberal, you're not a libertarian for one reason. The libertarians essentially believe that the function of the government is to prevent the use of force and fraud in all human interaction. And I think they're surely right to say that if you define these things correctly, stopping them is an essential element of peace. If people are out to threaten force in order to obtain what they want, the entire country will go to pieces. Every group will threaten every other group with violence if they don't comply. And so everybody believes that. But it turns out if you're a classical liberal, you don't think that protecting against force and fraud is going to be sufficient. And the first problem that you have is how you're going to run the protection. If you don't have any revenues for a government, who's going to protect whom from what? You'll be back in the state of nature. And there's the famous passages in Locke in the Second Treatise, which says that's just not going to work. So all of us have to surrender some of our property to the government. And in exchange, they receive the protection that it could afford to lives, liberties, and properties that we have. And that model was very much on the mind of the founders. And so unlike the libertarians who were opposed to taxes in principle, but accept them reluctantly in practice, the classical liberal says we have to have taxes. And then the question is how we organize them. And most classical liberals, starting with Aristotle and working forward, were generally in favor of flat taxes on broad bases of income because that limited the discretion of the government to pick favorites, but it didn't limit the amount of revenues that you could raise, which might vary wildly from conditions of peace to conditions of war. And then there was the defense of...
Hey, let me stop you right there for a second.
Because sure.
I want to... You've talked around it a little bit here, but I think that you, as a classical liberal and... by definition, are focused really on two major things that you've talked about. One, limited government, and two, property rights. So give us a little bit more on each of those.
Well, the limited government essentially is there are certain things that government can do, but they can't trespass beyond those limits. And so when you say that the Congress can't regulate freedom of speech or prohibit it, right, what you're saying is if you wish to criticize the government, they can't shut you down on the grounds that it's inimical to the public health. And on the other hand, if you start to speak something which turns out to be absolute lies about another individual, you're going to have to allow somebody to sue for defamation. And so the great problem with the First Amendment is you have to figure out which kinds of speeches are conducive to liberty and which kinds of speeches are essentially utterly inconsistent with it. And we have spent 200 years trying to go through all of that, organize the law of defamation, organize the law of privacy, and so forth. We've done better than random on this stuff, so it's not as though it's crazy. But the thing that you understand about constitutional interpretation within a classical liberal framework is what the Constitution sets out are presumptions to which there have to be intelligent exceptions. So freedom of speech applies, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't promote securities with frauds. You can't go to somebody and say, either you pay me or I'm going to kill you. These are all speech acts, but they have to be regulated. So what makes the interpretive problem difficult is you regulate them in part by saying there's an inherent power of the police for the government to prevent force and fraud because the libertarian constitution wants to protect freedom of speech. And if private individuals are a threat to it, then the state has to prevent them from upsetting it. And the other thing that the libertarians wanted is they said, in order to take property from people, you have to show perfect consent. Well, there are going to be huge holdout problems. And the example that everybody gives is you want to build a railroad that runs from San Francisco to St. Louis, say, and you want to meet in the middle. And somebody buys a plot of land a foot wide and says, you can't cross my land to the other side, at which point the private ownership of 1 foot of land on this railroad will immobilize this thing so that 2,000 miles of track cannot be used to its effectiveness. So the eminent domain power tries to put into place a great compromise. It says you can't take property from people and make them worse off by just taking it for nothing, but you can't let them hold out against the world. So you say, we're going to pay you the amount of money that that property would have been worth if there was no railroad in the picture. So you get your 50 cents or a dollar. And then in exchange, we could run the railroad so that everybody can benefit from it. And so essentially, the classical liberal, but not the libertarian, recognizes that there are a class of events known as collective action problems in which everybody wants the solution that you can never reach voluntarily because people are not going to surrender their rights if they think they can hold out. And the takings clause is designed to deal with all that stuff. So when I wrote my book on takings back in 1985, the point was so clear that this is essentially a repudiation of a hard libertarian position, but it was designed to prevent you from going over to the other extreme by having socialism. And the way in which you did that was twofold. one I've already mentioned, which is if you have to pay people so as to avoid their losses, it turns out you're not going to do things where their losses are greater than your gains. And so it's a very effective indirect defensive thing. So you think of the just compensation clause as a kind of a price system. And the government, if it wants to take something, has to pay the price. And sometimes the price is too high and they won't take it. That's not a bad result. That's a good result. And what we do is we have to enforce them. But there's another problem, which is much more subtle, and this one did not become very clear until later, which is if the government does take the property and there's a surplus between two people, can they rig the rules so that one guy gets 90% of the gain from the public taking and the other guy gets 10%? And the theory here is, of course, if you allow that property to be switched back and forth between these two guys, they're going to be political forces. They're called seeking for economic rents. That is the gain associated with something above and beyond the mere cost of keeping it into business, and the whole system will be dissipated. And so starting in the 1850s, in a whole variety of ways, a doctrine of unconstitutional conditions developed, which says these conditions you could attach, but these you can't. And I'll just give you the very simple intuition. I'm going to give you one simple case with two variations. You're driving in another state, and the issue is, have you consented to be your legal disputes arising out of an accident in that state to be litigated in that state? And it'd be absolutely crazy to say you have to go somewhere else to do it, right? But then you say, well, it's consent, and you express consent by crossing the boundary line between the state. Well, another state now passes a law and says, if you agree to enter into our state, you hereby agree that your divorce will be litigated in our state, even if you live in Washington, D.C., or somewhere else. And somebody says, well, you can't do that. And the reason you can't do it is most people say, I'm not likely to have an abortion. I'd rather have access to the state than give this thing up. But it's clearly crazy because now 20 states impose the same restriction and the country falls apart. So what you have to do is to examine what the conditions are. And the ones that are efficient, that is, make the system more secure, you keep. And the ones that are designed to beggar and to predators other states, you get rid of. This is not an easy thing to do, right? And so why is this all classical liberalism?
It's not an easy thing to do. You're going to finish your thing about why is it called classical liberalism.
Yeah.
And when you do that, I want you to end up that statement you're going to make with the focus on freedom, which is the key, and then tie freedom and property rights together for us.
Okay, well, this is tough, right? So you start looking at these kinds of situations and you realize that if the government has the power to take property and to distribute it to its friends and take it from somebody else, everything is at danger because you start to develop an investment and they'll find a strategy to take it. Now, why do we call this classical liberalism? Well, there are two reasons. One is that the term liberalism and used in the 19th century didn't quite mean what it did today. And then when you get American modern liberalism, it's a big state and progressive government. So the word classical is added on to describe a regime which was never called classical at its own time, because there wasn't the progressive movement to deal with. And so if you ask Hume, were you a classical liberal, he would know what you were talking about. But in retrospect, it's clear that this is really important because this is the basic point. When a classical liberal believes that property must be taken for the common good, it doesn't believe in unrequited redistribution from one group of people up to another. And in fact, if you go back to the founding period, if you look at the list of powers that were enumerated to the federal government, running a welfare system was not one of them. The theory at the time was under federalism. Each state itself decides what kind of welfare system it wants to have. The federal government has nothing to do with it. The transformation from classical liberalism to a form of progressivism took place in the New Deal, where all of these traditional restraints imposed in the belief that it's really dangerous to move too fast are disappeared. Who's the chief villain of the piece? If there is one, it's probably Woodrow Wilson. He was a very famous, very distinguished man. And in 1885, when he was basically 29 years old, he published a book called Congressional Government, in which he glorified the administrative state and its expertise and said that all these fussy rules about property rights and about separation of powers only prevent the public from articulating some great public goals and then having a bunch of technical experts try to implement them. And that expertise theme, coupled with the popular democracy theme, was what shaped a large amount of the work that was first done when Wilson, the same guy, when he becomes president in 1913, and he makes major reforms in this direction, and then by Franklin Roosevelt when he gets into power in 1933 after winning a pretty decisive investment.
All right, let me stop you there. Okay. I want to go back to Woodrow Wilson just for a brief part. And didn't he spend some time in academia where you spend all of your time, Richard?
He was a professor and he organized Princeton University.
We worry about the universities today. I worry about the universities then. That's been over 100 years ago. All right. Now, you've done a pretty good job of differentiating between classical liberal and today's liberal progressive socialist, which I sort of put on the spectrum there. But what's the difference in a classical liberal and what we would call a conservative today?
Well, I mean, it turns out it's less than you might think. But the basic argument with respect to classical liberalism was that in general, you used a series of rational provisions and argumentation to organize the structure in question. So the English Constitution, by this definition, would be conservative because you cannot point to a defining event like the Constitutional Convention. What you do is you see a series of conventions developing over time through trial and error. And the conservative position generally says that if it's a tradition that has lasted for a long period of time, by and large, it's going to be something that you don't want to meddle with. So the conservative position is essentially much more proactive and cautious. And in England, it turns out there wasn't any great transformation, and so it worked pretty well. To this very day, the English don't have a written constitution, and it was only in 2009 that they put together a Supreme Court. It used to be before then that the House of Lords had a specialized group of individuals who formed the judicial branch, and they were sitting there in this aristocratic body, and it seemed to work. And in fact, in the United States, Connecticut had such a system when it was early on because the states had a lot of variations in the way at which it went. But when you came to Philadelphia, what you mentioned was, well, they had to figure out what to do with the Articles of Convention. And what they did is they looked at the Articles of Confederation and they said, this horse won't run. And so what they decided to do was to start over again. And then what they did is they had a very sneaky provision in this new constitution, which says it will only take place if 9 out of 13 states sign it. So it has to be a clear majority. And then only among the states that sign it, right? And so what they did is instead of having to have unanimous consent to change the thing, they put this in place. And there were people like the Providence Plantations in Rhode Island, which didn't even bother to show up at the convention. So if there had to be unanimity, it would never happen. Well, then what they have to do is they got to figure out how they're going to negotiate this stuff. And the key feature for here is what's the role of state rights in the way in which this thing is going to be organized. And this was the central issue. So where does it begin? It begins with the first phrase in the Constitution. And it began originally, we the undersigned delegates of the Fairly States hereby agree to this Constitution with all sorts of principles. And then it looks as though the states themselves are forming a union, the way in which a bunch of small corporations form a big corporation over them. And one of these justices said, this is much too wordy. He says, we the people. And now all of a sudden the locus of power is not getting power through the states, but getting power directly from the people. Now, this, it turns out, had huge consequences in the way in which you think about the Constitution, because the deal on the drafting side was how it is you form a union without allowing one state to take advantage over another. It's the redistribution theme all over again. And there was this system of direct taxation having to be apportioned according to population. Now, why would you put something in there which simply says that if you have valuable land in one state, you pay more taxes or less taxes per unit than you do if you have valuable land in a poorer state? And when you think about it, if in fact you want to get the big states to come in, you have to make them guarantee that they're not going to be worse off after joining the union than they were before. And what you tell the little states is, we'll make you better off, but you can't beg it from the others. And the direct tax limitation was designed to protect against redistribution from rich states to poor states. And everybody understood that. by the time you get 100 years later, nobody's much thinking about states in the same kind of semi-sacred way that they thought of at the time. And so you get the tax movement, Pollock and Marshall, you know, fund, as to whether or not you can have a generalized income tax on the rents from property. And this is the biggest case in the 1890s with respect to taxation. I think they got it wrong on the way the facts organized, but you could see that the battle was still there. And then you look at the 16th Amendment on taxation, and it says taxes on income can be levied without regard to apportionments amongst the state and without regard to the census. That's pure history. What they mean is the income tax you could level without worrying about these redistributive effects across states.
Right. Okay, so that got to the 16th Amendment. Of course, we've had several more amendments. They all have to be amended by a certain number of states, et cetera, which we know. Now, in the short time that we have left, Richard, I'm going to ask you for a short answer here.
Whoops.
Differentiate a classical liberal from a neoliberal.
Well, I mean, neoliberal is one of these mysterious terms that nobody quite is concerned what it means. It comes up very lately. But sometimes a neoliberal is the kind of person who sorts of believes, oh, what we think is that in order to have the Constitution work, we not only have to have these structural kinds of situations, but we have to have a value structure which we're going to impose on everybody else. Say a religious belief of one form or another, or a kind of view of what we regard a decent person and human being to be. The classical liberal says the ends that most individuals choose are in accordance with their own taste, and we don't have a filter saying, well, you want to play poker and I want to read novels. Neoliberals, some of them, and sometimes they don't use that term, the new movement is, well, there's a set of preferred values that the state must implement, and if it starts to use individual choice to get them to non-preferred situation, then this is essentially a breakdown of the moral order of society. And my own view about that is it's very wrong, and I would put the point to you this way, is that when you have a society which is highly organized and homogenous on what they believe, a program, say, like Denmark before the recent invasions, or Norway and Sweden, where everybody has come to the same stock and they kind of share everything else, it's like a big old happy family, you can tolerate more redistribution in a state like that because everybody sort of has an interest in the welfare of the people who are net winners. So you give universal education, a place where everybody goes to college, well, you get more people in college, nobody's going to fund. But the United States is now an ethnic melting pot with all sorts of different peoples, all sorts of different groups, and their priorities are not aligned at all. And so the theory of the classical liberal constitution is you only want to use coercion in the organization of a government if, in fact, you're going to do something which is going to advance the welfare of everybody within the state within roughly the same proportion. And I think what you have to do is to recognize that expertise can be used for good purposes or for bad purposes. And the thing that you have to understand is how you keep the institutions from making it used for bad purposes. And our friend, one last sentence that our friend Madison said, is enlightened people will not always be at the helm. And that's why you have to be careful on how you structure government.
Unfortunately, you're right about that, my friend. And today's United States sort of proved that in the last few decades. Well, thank you again, Richard, because, you know, frankly, for you watching, it doesn't matter to me what you call yourself, but we hope that this program has given you some very good perspectives on what classical liberalism is, why it's important, at least important to think through, whether it changes anything that you think about politically or not is certainly up to you. Because as always, we talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.